CBI at 10. I suppose in the first few days following Russia's invasion of Ukraine, we found ourselves asking, what's going on? And now, even less than a fortnight in, we're trying to understand what it means. What it means, obviously, for people in Ukraine, what it means for the way the world works. For a lot of people joining us today, what it means for businesses in the UK. And I'm really delighted that Anna Leach, who's the Deputy Chief Economist for the CBI, is going to try and help us understand what the CBI is hearing, what people are doing and how that gets coordinated, but also the macroeconomic impact. And then Paul Madison and Jason Hungerford have been kind enough to join us. Jason is a partner at Mayor Brown, and I hope will help us understand a little bit of how sanctions work and how businesses respond when they are interacting with those companies that are sanctioned or potentially threatened by. And a lot of people are beginning to scratch their heads around what potential cyber retaliation or cyber vulnerabilities we're facing. And thank you very much, Paul, from the National Cybersecurity Centre for coming and joining us. I know your job is to think about resilience, and we're all thinking about that right now. So we'll come to you in a moment, Paul and Jason, but if you don't mind, I'm going to start with Anna. It feels odd talking to you because it's just a couple of years ago where there was another crisis like this, where it felt as though businesses were trying to figure out how to respond to something utterly overwhelming and unpredicted, but could impact companies in such a host of different ways. Can you tell us a little bit about what the CBI is hearing, what you're convening?
Yes, we've gone straight from a 1 in 300 year event to a 1 in 40 year event without much pause in between. Obviously, our thoughts continue to be with the civilians and families impacted by the unfolding events. That's what the companies we talk to are very much focused on at the moment, and what we're hearing is that absolute priority from companies on the ground. For those companies with employees in affected areas, particularly, of course, in Ukraine, some of them have set up specific crisis teams to support their staff. At the moment, in the CBI, we've got CBI colleagues who are directly impacted too, who've been telling us about the human cost and how it's affecting their families and friends. Some companies with employees in Ukraine have been helping with the evacuation or with large-scale donations to the Red Cross. Other companies who've got employees in Moscow, for example, are prepaying salaries to ensure that those employees are financed, because sanctions continue to build against Russian banks and the partners of Russian banks. At the CBI, we've been in regular dialogue with the ambassador of Ukraine since the invasion began, and we've been helping to convene business leaders in support of the humanitarian response. And firms have been supporting those efforts in several ways. Some firms have been donating food parcels, clothing parcels to support displaced families. Some members have been providing medical equipment to Ukraine and guidance and expertise with medical staff based in the UK. And some logistics companies have also helped by waiving fees and charges for humanitarian aid and logistics flights. The Trade Association Logistics UK have recently launched a campaign calling for companies in the logistics sector to continue to increase that support in moving donations. Poland and Germany in particular, where they can support those who've evacuated from Ukraine. And if any members would like to support that effort, there's an email address which I think should be going into the chat. Supplyukraine@logistics.org.uk is the email to use if you would like to get involved or be more engaged in that approach. And then just finally, there's a new Minister for Refugees, Richard Harrington, MP. The CBI has long supported the Lift the Ban campaign, which allows asylum seekers to work without having to wait for refugee status. And we hope that that's something that will be considered by this new minister.
Can I just ask you about that for a second, Anna? Because I think there's sort of three sort of questions in the what can we do section. There's the, as you say, how do you provide kind of material assistance to Ukraine and to refugees from Ukraine? Then, as you say, there's the immigration question, the asylum seekers question, and how you can support. Just to be a little bit more detailed about that, the CBI is making the case to try and help on a policy level. If you as a company want to say, look, we've got jobs, or we have vacancies, or we're willing to make those vacancies, Is it helpful to the CBI if those companies contact you and let you know that they're willing to do those things? Does that help with the argument with government? How should business interact?
Yes, absolutely. Do continue to get in touch with the CBI on matters such as that, and any in relation to the Ukraine as well. We've got an insights portal, insights@cbi.org.uk. That's the best place to push that information to. That's our primary source of member information. And it definitely helps when we have specific examples of companies who are interested in changing the policy. It definitely adds weight to our pushes with government.
And then, Anna, can I ask you just a third element, which, and I don't know whether this has come up from companies from the CBI is listening to, when it comes to sort of big ticket sanctions, government sanctions, with Jason in a minute, but what about businesses that themselves have interests in Russia or have clients that are Russian that are not sanctioned? Is the CBI trying to help people navigate whether or not they voluntarily change their business practices, whether they get guidance from government on how to do that, or has this not really come up?
It's definitely come up. Of course, we recognise the complexity for companies being caught in the middle in that way, both wanting to continue operating, but also sensitive to the implications of trading in whatever context in that area of the world. So yes, we are supporting companies in navigating those complex choices. Those are decisions that need to be made by an individual company. We're not giving advice to companies on what they should be doing in that regard. But we will help, we will always be helping them navigate the complex choices.
So as I said, we'll come in a moment to some of those sanctions questions and the cyber security questions. But if you like, Anna, can I just ask you a little bit about the day job? I don't know whether this is like the most interesting time ever to be an economist or the most confounding, but I was just thinking, trying to model a pandemic that hasn't been before, trying to understand inflation and labor market patterns that we haven't seen before. And now this, how do you understand it? And how do you help businesses who are beginning to look at the oil price and think to themselves, this is going to have a real economy impact? I just can't tell what it is.
Well, sadly, there's quite a lot of experience of wars globally. So in that context, there's quite a lot of economic modelling experience available to us, at the headline level anyway, to analyse how the economy will be impacted and, to a degree, the scale of impact. So for the UK, the main channels of impact are via trade, price and feasibility, financial markets, which is cost and access to funding, and through confidence to spend, and that's amongst both businesses and consumers, and most obviously via commodity markets, both prices and availability of key commodities. What inevitably makes this war the most recent war of significance globally is that global supply chains and financial market interconnectivity are incredibly complicated, and there will be surprising channels of impact that will arise, which the models will not be able to help us find, but our conversations with companies will help us. As an example of the kind of thing I'm talking about there, if you think back to October last year, we had that US fertilizer plant suspending operations because of the rising gas prices. And then it turned out that that had major implications for UK food security because it provided 60% of the UK's carbon dioxide. That's the kind of issue that as economists we worry about because it's quite difficult to predict, but we're doing our best. But on the more traditional channels of impact, the UK has relatively limited direct exposure to Russia and Ukraine via trade and financial markets. Russia represents 1% of UK exports, and Ukraine is less than that. And direct financial market exposure is likewise limited. But it's the presence of Russia and Ukraine in the supply of key global commodities, which is the most destructive thing we're seeing. Oil prices are the big one, of course, up more than 60% now since the beginning of the year and hovering around their highest since 2008. And that's around Russia being, you know, one of the third biggest oil supplier in the world, a significant supplier of gas as well. Russia and Ukraine supply around half of global pig iron exports, double-digit shares of iron and steel products, 90% of neon, which is used in semiconductors, 43% of palladium, crucial in catalytic converters, crucial in nickel. London Metal Exchange has been forced to suspend nickel trading. Ukraine is one of the most significant suppliers of wheat as well, as is Russia. Wheat prices are soaring. So the impact is significant via that channel. And if you just play through a 60% rise in oil alone, not allowing for any other commodity prices, through to inflation, that pushes the April inflation peak above 8% and knocks about 1 percentage point off growth this year. And that's without what's going on in food, that's without what's going on in gas, and that's without making any allowance for further price rises in the future and the likely length of the disruption. So we're talking about very significant impacts for the cost of living crisis and for the outlook for growth in the UK.
And Anna, thank you. It's really helpful, if worrying, to hear that in some detail. Two questions. One is, if you are seeing energy prices rise at that kind of level, there are going to be some businesses that can't sustain that. There will, I suppose, be something of a question for government, which is subsidy, how much, which companies get a subsidy, or rationing, control of energy to different kinds of sectors or businesses. Do you hear any of that? And what, if anything, is the CBI's best view on how to deal with the pressure on energy?
Of course, we do definitely hear it from the government. And you see it in what they're announcing as well. The government is clearly focused on the geopolitics of the current situation. It's looking to the UK's energy security, looking at how we can increase our own supplies of oil, as global oil markets are set to be so profoundly disrupted in the near term. Of course, it is looking to the security of the UK economy and the resilience of it. And that is a key priority that we're discussing with them right now. We absolutely agree that energy intensive industries are at the forefront of the crisis from a business perspective. But all companies, because of the scale of the increase, are vulnerable to the implications of this energy crisis, as are consumers. Both via petrol pump prices and also via an unthinkable potential future increase in the price cap in October. We thought it was bad enough when it rose so significantly in April, and now we're looking at it potentially taking place again. So the government has that dual priority of insulating business to keep it up and running and insulating consumers to the best that they can from a cost of living crisis in the middle of a geopolitical crisis. It's an incredibly complex place.
Okay, well, let's come back to if we can, Anna, let's come back to a couple of those things, particularly this October price cap question. But I know there's some people who are interested too in the macro, kind of, you begin to hear words like stagflation bandied about and what that means. Yeah. That may be premature or misguided. So I'm going to come back to you in a bit. But I'd like to hear from Jason, because one of the things that Anna just talked about there was, you know, disruption of certain channels of trade to which we're not that exposed, but then certain areas of business where we are. And I just wondered, Jason, if you would, just before we get into the details of how you deal with sanctioned companies, just from your perspective, what your read is of what the impact of these sanctions are likely to be, and what, there's a lot written about the strength or weakness of them. What's your read of them so far?
And I said a moment ago that there is, for economists, there's precedent, as one would expect, to calculate the impact that the current situation will have on the economy. From a sanctions practitioner's perspective, there is no precedent in the sanctions world, so to speak, for what we've seen over the past fortnight. I mean, some of the tools, which maybe we can talk about, the individual sanctions measures are things that have existed before and that we know how to navigate, although there are some novel ones as well. But we've never seen a sanctions program of this scope or a sanctions regime set up with such speed in the past. I mean, there are other countries that are currently subject to sanctions that are broader. From a U.S. perspective, that would be Cuba, and Iran, and obviously from the EU perspective in the past, Iran was one of those. But no country of such financial significance as Russia has been subject to this scale of sanctions regime. And so the short-term effects on corporates and financial institutions for many of them has been seismic already. And over the long term, and I regret to say long term is probably what we're looking at. It's going to affect their for some companies their economic outlooks quite significantly.
So Andres, can you just help us? I had to interview an individual who himself was sanctioned last week, and on Monday he was a billionaire. On Tuesday he found the EU sanctioned him. On the Wednesday, he was lobbying and using all the forces of a huge company to try and stop the UK from sanctioning him. And on Thursday, he couldn't use his credit card. He just discovered it was a complete change. Mm-hmm. The people working in the company were unclear whether or not they could get paid. It felt really clear what was the treatment of him. It felt quite unclear what the treatment was of people working in his company. It felt unclear still of what were the relationships between those companies that serviced that company and then the supply chains to them. So would you mind just taking us through it, how sanctions work, if you like, from the sanctioned individual or entity out to those people who work with them?
Sure. So the kind of sanction that you're referring to is in some UK and EU terms called an assets freeze. In the US, it's called blocking sanctions. And it's whilst there are a number of sort of flavors, if you will, of sanctions, the basic one, the one that is most widely implemented and the one that we're all most familiar with is the assets freeze. Those relationships that you describe between the sanctioned individual and its company and his or her company and their employees and companies that provide services to them, it can seem perhaps that the implications for all those different entities and individuals would be confusing, but they are often quite simple, particularly if we're all kind of talking within one jurisdiction. We can maybe get to that in a minute. So an assets freeze essentially prohibits. I mean, if you're a UK national and UK assets freeze, and if I'm a sanctioned person, it'd prohibit you from dealing with me in virtually any way. So you couldn't deal with my assets, funds, debt, any economic resource. You can't deal with them. And if they come into your possession or control, you have to freeze them and report them to the government. So your billionaire individual couldn't use his credit card. It's because the financial institutions that hold that person's wealth would be prohibited from processing withdrawals. And if they received any deposits, they would have to freeze them. The assets freeze then extends to any entity that individual owns or otherwise controls. So that would be the company. The employees of that company aren't sanctioned, but they themselves would find it difficult, would find it prohibited, for instance, to be paid by that company because that company's assets would also be blocked in the financial institutions. The company providing the service providers to that sanctioned company could no longer provide services for the most part to that sanctioned company and also certainly couldn't be paid by it. So you see there's a kind of trickle down effect, if you will, from sanctioning an individual. It affects not only that individual's business and their wealth, but also the ability of any other entity or individual really to interact with that individual or business in any kind of economic sense.
And Jason, just for those those people, if you like, further down the food chain, if you are a supplier and your payments have been frozen, can you reasonably expect that they will be reimbursed, or should you have no expectation of that?
Sorry, I want to make sure I've
I provide food to a multinational company. Its assets are frozen. I'm now not getting paid. Can I expect that I will get paid at some point in the future, or can seek to be paid at some point in the future, mm-hmm. or should I have no expectation of that?
Yeah, so in that particular circumstance, it could be that you could apply for a license to receive that payment. And depending on the circumstance, that may or may not be looked at favorably. Where it's, let's say, we're talking about a UK government, a UK company owed money by a sanctioned party. I think we, you know, for work previously done, I think we could probably expect that the Treasury would look favorably on a license like that, obviously considering all the circumstances. If it were the other way around, if the British company owed money to the sanctioned individual, then unlikely to be able to make that payment. And again, taking into account all the circumstances. As far as outside of licensing, wait until the sanctions are lifted, which obviously there's no end date on those. So it does. But if I could comment on the question about sort of supply chain, I mean, this is really the issue for businesses, supply chains, and you know, where does what you purchase come from? And then going the other way, not only your direct customers, but your distribution channels, where are your goods going to end up? Because the business is on the hook for their indirect dealing, at least potentially on the hook for the indirect dealing that it might do through distributors, through agents, and also for the origin of its goods, whom they're dealing with in their supply chain. If your supplier's supplier is owned by a sanctioned individual, then arguably speaking, you are in violation of the sanctions, or could be in violation of the sanctions through that purchase. So, and it's not a good defense to say, to just bury your head in the sand and say, well, look, I didn't know this. They're not actually my direct, you know, contact. They're my contact. Not good enough.
So practically speaking, just on that, how do you find out whether or not you're dealing with indirectly with a sanctioned entity?
It's a matter of putting the effort in and asking the questions, and where you are not satisfied that you know the identity through your supply chain, at least back to a reasonable level, then cease to do business with them. And it's not just, again, we talked about ownership. If your supplier's supplier is, you know, Acme Incorporated, you know, then who owns Acme Incorporated? It matters.
Yeah. Jason, can I just ask you, lots of people have this question about whether sanctions work. And I just wanted to ask it in a slightly different way, which is, how do they work? If the business is, if you like, either invisible or offshore, if it's a private rather than a publicly listed investment, or if it's operated through a company that's held offshore, is it then the case that actually there's great potential for people to be going out buying Gazprom shares on the cheap, looking to making investments outside the UK, and that we have in effect a very uneven marketplace, heavily sanctioned entities and people that are, you know, playing market arbitrage?
Okay, it's a good question. I think the question basically is, how far does the jurisdiction of a sanctioning authority go? I mean, with Gazprom shares, that might be maybe an easier example, simply because there are sort of, I won't go into it, but there are sort of broader controls on financial services sector, and also there is a hyperactive at times, but certainly a conservative sense of risk in that sector in dealing with sanctioned parties. But I'll take the question as, if we just kind of avoid the UK and avoid the EU and avoid the US, for that matter, avoid Canada, avoid Japan, avoid Australia, all of this kind of coalition of kind of sanctioning authorities at this stage, you know, can a sanctioned Russian individuals, say, continue to deal in their wealth and continue to make money? Well, the answer is, well, of course. I mean, of course, the world's a big place, and there are always places to make money, and also always people who will do business with sanctioned individuals and entities. But the, I mean, those countries that I mentioned make up quite a lot of the world's commerce. They also have collectively, and some more than others, I would say the U.S. is on one end of the spectrum. The U.K. is not quite to that side, but is taking steps in that direction. See its jurisdiction under sanctions as very, very broad. And so, I mean, here's an example from a question I had last night from a financial services client, a completely non-UK trade in securities. Euro-denominated, well, say not Euro, let's say it's only a UK sanctions trade. Euro-denominated securities trade entirely outside of the UK, but their US branch has an IT system that processes the transaction. There's some administrative support, but look, this is a trade between non-UK banks, a non-UK security, etc. That UK, the UK branch can't provide those services and support of that entirely non-UK activity, because that's essentially dealing in the assets of the sanctioned person. That the security is never coming into the UK. There's no way to hold it and freeze it like we're supposed to do under the sanctions. But that UK company still can't facilitate that transaction. And so you can see where it's not the, the kind of nexus, so to speak, with the UK or with the US. It can be quite tenuous. And the sanctioning authority will assert its jurisdiction over that transaction.
It's almost like anything that touches it along the way. That's what you've sort of trying to track, isn't it? Jason, I'd love to talk longer, but I also want to make sure that we've got some time just to hear about these cybersecurity issues. Paul, sort of cutting to the chase, have you seen any evidence so far of any cyber attacks on UK organizations or businesses?
So, of course, we see cyber attacks on UK organisations and businesses all the time. But that's the key point here, isn't it? Has the risk increased? And yes, it has. And we're keen to raise that. And thank you for the opportunity to speak this morning. But the press reporting has sort of gone to two extremes on occasions. One is that, you know, cyber war and cyber Armageddon is imminent. And secondly, and more recently, actually, why haven't we seen more cyber? How come it hasn't been as prominent? And actually, of course, the reality is a lot more complex. So we know there is an existing threat, cyber threat that impacts UK organisations. We've called out Russia on a number of occasions as one of those, the biggest malicious cyber state threat that we face. And predominantly that's been sort of data theft and also sort of information and influence operations. But of course, you know, really important for business and probably the biggest threat to business has been ransomware. Ransomware and cybercrime gangs, predominantly Russian speaking, often based in Russia or, you know, countries nearby, and are not being pursued through law enforcement means in those countries. It gives them a free environment. So I think there's already an existing level of threat from Russia. What we've seen Russia do in previous conflicts, including against Ukraine and in Georgia, is deploy more disruptive cyber capabilities in order to, as part of their, you know, hybrid approach to these kind of warfare and these kind of conflicts. And we have seen this in Ukraine. Both in the lead up to the invasion and then subsequently, we've seen a lot of distributed denial of service attacks, DDoS, which is a relatively unsophisticated but, you know, quite frequently used way of trying to just cause a bit of interruption and disruption to services. But more significantly, we saw the deployment of wiper malware. So this is malware that actually not dissimilar from ransomware, to be honest. You know, they will destroy the information on your computers, prevent them from being used, and cause quite significant disruption. I think what we'll find is, and quite rightly, obviously, with the humanitarian crisis and the, you know, the military aspects, you know, we'll hear a bit more over time quite how significant some of those operations have been in Ukraine. And the thing that we feared most, and thinking about the threat to the UK and why we've been pushing guidance on heightened threats, of course, there's a potential for spillover, as you mentioned, you know, the indirect impact. And we've seen this before. A Russian attack in 2017 on Ukraine called NotPetya had a fairly massive disruptive impact, costing billions for multinational companies because they had presence in Ukraine and it spread through their networks. And we've seen a bit of spillover already. So a couple of companies have been affected in Latvia and Lithuania at the start of this. And that wiper malware that I talked about is, is starting, the indications that it might have spread beyond the borders of Ukraine. So there is a danger in this spillover that we've seen and those indirect impacts on UK companies. And certainly any organisation with links into the Ukraine or the region needs to be thinking about those connections as part of their cybersecurity really quite seriously. But I think the thing that people are worried about, sorry, did you want to come in?
Okay.
I think the thing that people are worried about, of course, is a direct and deliberate targeted attack on the UK, potentially in response to the sanctions that we've talked about. And just as the UK government representative on this, I should reinforce what Anna and Jason have both said, which is that as well as, you know, thinking about the geopolitical aspects of this, and of course, you know, a completely unjustified, unprovoked invasion of a sovereign democratic country causing huge humanitarian crisis. This is a moment we do have to stand up and act. But as we do this, the government has been all along considering the impacts on domestically and our domestic resilience, and cyber has been considered as part of that. So we think at the moment there's a low likelihood of that kind of direct, deliberate disruptive attack. We don't have any sort of specific threats or incidents yet that have reflected that kind of intent. But we often see a lot of cyber incidents are often much more complex and more difficult to understand than perhaps you see in Hollywood films. And I think, again, Anna's point about the complexity of supply chains, you can have what we've learned over the last few years, you can have a quite significant effect in the UK through a very complex supply chain delivered from a cyber operation.
So, Paul, can I do a few different things with your sort of resilience and strategy hat on? On the resilience front, and I know people talk about this a lot of the time, but if you're running a company now and you are fearful of what might be to come, what are the best steps that you can take that improve the resilience of the business?
Yeah, so there's a short-term and a long-term answer to this. And so what I'd really like, anybody on the call, please go and see ncsc.gov.uk. So that's our website. And then on the front page, you'll see two pieces of really important guidance. The first, actually, our flag first, is ransomware. So particularly as a business in the UK, please look at that guidance and look at how you protect yourself, because that continues to be a really significant threat. And it could potentially get worse if Russia takes even less steps to sort of clamp down on criminal gangs. But the other piece of guidance is specific to the Ukraine conflict. And that's where we've said, like, in a period of heightened threat, these are specific short-term measures you can take to raise your resilience. Now, we recognize people can't rebuild their networks and suddenly make massive investments and improve their defenses. But there are 11 steps in there. You know, improve your logging, make sure you've checked your access controls, you know, make sure you've got an incident plan and you've practiced how you would respond to an incident if it does happen. There's also links to some NCSC services. So join our cybersecurity information sharing partnership to get more information. We have an early warning service, which is if you provide us details of your organization and its IP ranges and its internet footprint, we can put it into our systems. And if we generate any threat intelligence or precursor information, we can tip you automatically to detect it and hopefully prevent attacks. So there's a range of steps there you can take, and please have a look at that. In the longer term, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, so
in the longer term, I think what this crisis has shown is that, you know, well, I mean, resilience generally is massively strategically important, and that's a key part of the government's integrated review and plans for the next few years. But cyber resilience in particular, because the threat and the technology keeps evolving, we're not where we need to be. You know, we are not as resilient as we need to be, and therefore there's a need for a sort of effort across the board to improve that in the sort of medium to long term. And again, our website has a lot of guidance on how organisations of different sizes, because obviously a small organisation, you know, it's more appropriate to take different steps compared to a larger or more complex or piece of the organisation in the critical national infrastructure.
And then can I just ask you about response? You know, we saw in the States, Anna mentioned, you know, fertilizer plant, you'll remember Colonial Pipeline, the debate around what the responsible response of a business is in the event that it does get a ransomware attack. Is your advice to them, contact the National Cybersecurity Center and tell them exactly what's happening? Is that best practice?
Yes, it is. In fact, there's a new reporting tool on gov.uk if you search cyber incidents, which will take you through a process to help you report, because there's a number of different organisations that need to be involved. So if it's a nationally significant incident, the NCSC can help and coordinate and respond. But obviously law enforcement and often ransomware is always a crime as well, and they're positioned to help. But also there's a regulatory aspect to this as well, and often it's important to make sure that you're contacting your regulator. I think the key question is obviously, do you pay a ransom? And our advice is very strongly not to pay a ransom. For one, it's not a guarantee you'll get your data back. But two, every time somebody pays a ransom, it increases the threat both to their sector and to, you know, other organizations. And that's why these criminals are so successful. And to be honest, if you've got the right incident management plan, if you've got backups and you've practiced it, organizations can restore their services fairly quickly with minimal disruption and without having to have paid a ransom.
And I know this is a thorny question, Paul, but as I understand, there's not a legal requirement to report or a legal requirement not to pay. The government's role is advisory in that. Do you have a view on whether or not that should change?
Well, so it's quite nuanced, actually. And the sanctions, this plays into the sanctions debate, right? So if you pay a ransom to a sanctioned entity, an individual, then obviously you are committing a crime. And the increase in sanctions mean there's more entities in Russia that, you know, that's potentially going to affect. And I think that needs to be taken into consideration. There was also a legal duty, depending on what sector and what data in the incident, to report to the relevant regulator, depending on what industry you're in. And of course, you need to meet your regulatory obligations. So, but from the NCSC's perspective, we're not a regulator and we're not a law enforcement body. And we're here really to help organisations. So you can report, and we're keen that people report to us voluntarily, and they do, because we want to help, but more than that, we want to learn so that we can protect other organisations from similar threats. So we do actually encourage more voluntary, and we're not supportive of any kind of mandatory across the board reporting system, because I think it will drive down to the minimum, you know, what people are prepared to do, whereas we prefer to encourage a more collective whole of society response to cyber issues.
And then the one final question, you mentioned at the beginning, of course, these cyber attacks happening all the time. The question is whether or not there's an uptick, Paul. And then this sort of weird world we live in where either it's all about to hit us or it's surprisingly not happened at all. What's the best place to get real-time information on what the volume of denial of service attacks or ransomware attacks is? How best can, if you're running a business, you actually get a sense of what the lie of the land is?
Yeah, it's a good question, actually. I mean, partly because, you know, we get incidents reported to us and we regularly put out information, particularly on the more significant ones. So obviously our website's a good place to keep up to date with news, and we do a weekly threat update and things. But there's a lot of good information out there for your, particularly those who are in the business of IT security from industry, actually. And you know, recommend following that, because that's often gives you some of the insights. But to be honest, it's not easy, because it depends on how much is reported, and we often don't know a lot about what's going on. So you have to be very careful that you don't extrapolate from reported incidents into the overall sort of, you know, volume and scale of the threat. I mean, I think what this period has sort of brought really to home is actually, you know, you need to be threat informed, but understanding, and you can't combat this just by understanding the threat, right? You need to raise your resilience to all threats. And that's why both the ransomware and the heightened threat guidance we've put out they're not mutually exclusive. They're supportive, right? You protect yourself from one threat, you're protecting yourself from other threats at the same time. And that's why raising the bar more generally is the strategic response to this.
Paul, thank you. I wanted, just in the last couple of minutes, I said I was going to come back to Anna, just because I think, Anna, you raised a point that people have been wondering about, what all the reporting on the price of Brent crude, or what the impact is likely to be on higher gas prices. And I felt as though you made it quite real in saying, look, what happens if there's got to be another re-rating in the October price cap? Given that the price cap, and I don't understand the mechanics of it, but I think its largest component is wholesale energy prices. So presumably if those increase, most likely the price cap rises as well. Is that what you're beginning to forecast for?
We're not putting it into forecast as yet, because it's too early. Because it, right. You know, even though a lot has happened in the last couple of weeks, it's only been 2 weeks. So right. Trying to work out what is likely to occur that many months ahead is just a little bit premature. The price cap itself, there is technically flexibility regarding the methodology by which it is calculated. So it's not even entirely predictable. Even if we knew for sure where gas prices were headed, what the implications would necessarily be for the price cap. But we will get, you know, in a month, in 2 months, we will start, more forecasters will start making that call regarding an October price cap impact on the inflation outlook for this year. We're just wary of going too quickly on that one, because, you know, in all of these things, you don't want to make things look worse than they are too early. You know, we've got to be realistic, but we've got to be practical.
Yeah, and on that, Anna, I'm aware of the fact that
you know, people can be forgiven for just being exhausted by the buffeting information, not just the distressing information from Ukraine, but in business terms, the buffeting information on the macroeconomic picture. You often then hear these new things to worry about. The one of the week has been stagflation. And I just wonder whether you could tell us what it is and whether or not we do actually need to worry about it.
So stagflation is when you've got weakening growth and rising inflation. And we definitely have an environment where in the inflation outlook is getting worse. So the trajectory for inflation is now higher. And it literally just takes off growth. When you have an increase in commodity prices like we have had, it redistributes wealth from commodity consuming economies to commodity producing economies. It's a straight transfer, and that has a very direct impact on growth. And then of course we've heard about the complexity and breadth of sanctions that are happening, and there may still be more yet to come, and that will feed through into growth as well. So we are in that kind of environment. You call it what you will, it's a complicated environment, and it's definitely more complicated for the Bank of England now, because they would love to look through an external supply shock like this. If we weren't already in a high inflationary environment going into this crisis, they would be looking to hold fire on interest rates to protect growth. But inflation has been high for a long time already. They were already worried about it becoming entrenched. And now that worry will have exacerbated while the growth outlook has weakened. So their decision-making context is wildly complicated now.
Well, this tees up nicely what we're going to do next week, because at next week's CBR at 10, we're going to try and look at the longer economic impacts, some of the choices for the Bank of England and for policymakers, but also the points on commodity prices and supply chain. So please do join us next week. There's been so much to think about, so much to digest here. You could have had, frankly, a two-hour session on each and every one of these issues, cyber sanctions and the economic outlook. But I know people have got work to go to and things to do. Thank you for taking the time for joining us. But a big and heartfelt thank you to Paul Madison, to Jason Hungerford, and Anna Leach. Thanks very much, everyone. Have a good day.